Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update live from Jerusalem is Mr. Honlein here at JM in the AM. Malcolm, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, especially from the Holy City.
Man, I can only imagine how amazing it is today. So I would guess, based on the schedule you gave us last week, that you did have an opportunity, in fact, already this week, to meet with the Prime Minister and other public officials in the State of Israel. First of all, is the Prime Minister aware of the statements that President Obama is making regarding the Middle East peace process and the aftermath of their meetings here in Washington? In specific, some of the quotes that are getting around from the Democratic fundraisers that he's been holding. Is the Prime Minister aware of what's happening on this end?
The Prime Minister is well aware, as are most people who follow American politics more closely than most Americans do, because for them every utterance has significance and consequences, and the level of interest and the discussion about Republican alternatives, about the various events of the last few weeks is almost universal. So the Prime Minister is well aware of what's going on.
I'm going to pull up one of the quotes, and you'll tell me if people are overreacting to this or not. Apparently, at one of these fundraisers that cost over $25,000 a plate, by the way, which is that's quite a dinner, frankly. He said there are going to be moments over the course of the next 6 months, or the next 12 months, or the next 24 months, in which there may be tactical disagreements between the U.S. and Israel in terms of how we approach these difficult problems. He said the Hamas-Fatah government is going to require that not only this administration employ all of its creative powers to try to bring about peace in the region, but it's also going to require all of you, as engaged citizens of the U.S. who are friends of Israel, making sure that you're helping to shape how both Americans and Israelis think about the opportunities and challenges. Some people are making a big deal about these quotes, that they're inappropriate. What's your reaction to them?
Well, I hadn't seen that exact quote in its full text. It's not dissimilar to something that the president has said on earlier occasions. And the propriety of that, I think, is subject to discussion. I think that the Jewish people in Israel have proven consistently their commitment to peace, that their willingness to sacrifice for real peace. The Hamas-Fatah coalition and perhaps government at some point, but I don't think you can describe it as such, and I think the long-term future for that marriage is pretty shaky. The obstacle is them, and he should be appealing to the Palestinians and Arabs to think about what do you do when you have a terrorist organization joining the government, and whether you put, you know, the costume of a technocrat government when you see that the Hamas has refused that the Fayyad be prime minister, when they refuse to adopt the principles that the Europeans laid out or the basis of the roadmap. So the onus is not one that should be borne by American Jews who and friends of Israel, who consistently and constantly, not just now but for the last 100 years, were the ones who accepted every logical arrangement for peace, and we're ready to accept a reasonable approach now.
But the scary part is that it's not the Hamas end that I'm concerned about. It's the PA end that looks like it's not shaky. In other words, you may be right that it's the radical side that, you know, doesn't like this arrangement as much as they should or you'd expect or might want, but it's the PA side that seems to be much more comfortable with the whole thing.
Well, first of all, the PA is not, there is not a PA. You have a lot of different elements today, but you have the leader is clearly Abu Mazen, who everybody says is looking at his legacy. He wants to show that he didn't make any concession, that he will want to get a declaration of a state, that he brought unity again together in his government by bringing Hamas and Fatah together. You're quite right that the positions that he has articulated and his unwillingness to come to the table before he had the burden of Hamas inside the government, an arrangement that he sought and he brought about, again, I don't think it is finalized and perhaps will never be. So it is the attitude of the PA, the PA's leadership, the fact that they're paying the salaries of terrorists, thousands of them sitting in Israeli jails and supposedly giving them a bonus now. This is money that's coming from aid sources, from the money that comes to the PA, which is the largest recipient per capita of aid anywhere. The questions, though, really have to be directed at the other side at this point.
Right, well...
Could there be tactical issues? Of course, there are always going to be issues between countries. The best of allies have issues that come up. I don't know what tactical means when it comes to the peace process, and words do matter. Words have consequences. People use words to determine or interpret a policy or determine a policy.
I just don't know what the president, and I got to get to about the, you know, the prime minister's comments too this week, but I just don't understand what the president's strategy is. You walk into a room of supporters, what do you expect? Are you by putting the pressure on them, on the people sitting there, to act more boldly in this process? Is it in fact putting the burden on the shoulders of the prime minister, putting pressure on Israel? I'm not quite sure how it works.
Well, firstly, there were many other comments made by the president, some that were more positive, described the commitment to Israel's security and that fact.
Well, it was a fundraiser, after all.
Excellent. Pardon me?
It was a fundraiser, after all. He had to cover those bases.
Well, that's exactly, and that's why I'm responding to the question, which is a logical one. Why would he do it there? You would seem that you would
correct,
say that
right.
We're working together, we're looking to be able to work together in the future, not
right.
that...
Right.
We're going to raise differences.
Right.
The differences will arise anyway. That's not a burden this administration any different than every administration.
Correct.
Bore.
That's why it seems like just a drop of a strange thing. All right, I got to take advantage of the fact that you've been in Israel this week. We'll ask you in a second about your meetings with the prime minister. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Programming note, important, the weekly update. Summer hiatus, so to speak, next week and the week after. In fact, 2 weeks from today, we're broadcasting live from Champions Gate down in Florida. The 15th of July, we'll do this again and get rolling with the weekly update. So we're so curious, and I know you're so limited in what you can tell us, because all these things, I'm sure, are private conversations between you and the prime minister, and you know, all this type of stuff probably doesn't belong in this forum. But we're so curious, after everything that happened here in Washington and all the criticism and praise that the prime minister got, you know, for the back and forth with the president of the United States, what's the inside word? What did the prime minister tell you in review of the whole episode that he experienced here in Washington?
Well, the truth is that we did not go into detail into what happened. We discussed much more what is happening and what will happen in September, the unilateral declaration. We discussed events in Turkey or in Syria and in other countries in the region, and meetings that we've had with some of the leaders discussing, obviously, U.S. policy and the direction of U.S. policy, more so than, you know, the occurrences during those days, which are essentially behind us. And now we have such a difficult agenda facing us. It's a complex agenda. And we also went to introduce the new chairman of the conference, Richard Stone, and to thank the past chairman, which has become a tradition over the last 20 years, and met many of the ministers and President Peres and Prime Minister Lieberman to discuss really serious issues. And the truth is that we had more than an hour of a really intensive discussion and hardly got through half the agenda of things that we wanted to discuss.
So you couldn't even get an indication about all the conjecturing that was done about how uncomfortable that room was at the White House, if in fact that was true or not.
Well, I think that's really for private discussion. So, you know, if the prime minister discusses something like that. But in terms of the U.S. policy, obviously they're very concerned about the nuance or about the tone of relations.
Okay.
Dennis Ross has been here a couple times. There are ongoing efforts to establish some foundation for renewing talks. Israeli representatives, those of representing the prime minister, have been in Washington on a regular basis, and that will continue. Part of the goal is to avoid this unilateral declaration by the Palestinians by creating some momentum that will give Abbas cover to get out of this. But he continues on that road, although, as I said, I'm skeptical about whether he, in fact, will follow through. We'll know July 15th if he sends in the letter, and then at that time we will decide the next phase of our campaign about this. We continue to meet with officials. Israel obviously takes it seriously because of the potential ramifications. Not that it changes things on the ground, but it can change things in terms of their ability to go to international courts and also the expectations of the people. And that's when you get trouble, when you get violence. Those are raised and not met. And in fact, the UN vote, should it take place in the General Assembly, because we know the Security Council will face the veto of the United States, and again, an example of where the United States and Israel are together, the General Assembly vote plays out at a very different level, but people won't see the change and won't feel it,
right,
and will
right.
only be more frustrated.
Right, that's true. All right, so in terms of you being in Jerusalem, the three most dominant topics were, I guess, Iran, Turkey, and the unilateral declaration of Palestinian state. Those would be your top three.
Well, I would say it's Iran, certainly, and when we see the split in Iran that we've talked about, the increasing U.S. sanctions and attempts to go to the U.N., Iran's heavy investment in Syria, the fact that now you have a possibility of a of the report on the Hariri assassination coming out that will blame Syria, something Assad has feared greatly, doesn't exonerate Hezbollah, but it says that the orders that came from Syria and couldn't have happened without Assad's personal okay. And Assad made the speech this week that proved again disappointing, leading to more frustration. I don't think you've had the critical mass in the streets of Syria, but enough to both cause the reaction that it did and to give Iran greater impetus to provide more aid and more involvement, which not all of the people there are welcome. At the same time, Turkey has been moving away from Syria and building now additional fortifications on its border, camps on the other side of the Syrian side, talking about that buffer zone, because, and the public criticism, although, Syria, Turkey, and Iran, we discussed many times, had formed this coalition, and Iran, the sanctions in Iran continue to benefit Turkey, which is used to bypass the banking restrictions and other restrictions. Iran's bold announcements about tripling the enrichment of uranium, putting their submarines in the Gulf of Aden, other steps that they've taken, their continued involvement and growing involvement inside Syria and certainly in Lebanon, where Hezbollah formed a government this week with 18 Hezbollah ministers out of 30 members of the cabinet. This is 8 more than last time, so it shows that they're solidifying their role, which means Iran is solidifying its hold on Lebanon. And in Syria, just another second, because I know people are very interested. We saw the story this week about Rami Mahlouf, the cousin of Assad, who was considered his banker, the treasurer, and the target of many of the demonstrations, announced that he was stepping down and retiring and devoting himself to charity and gave $1 billion to stabilize the central bank in Syria because they can't pay salaries. The business community supposedly is beginning to contribute to the rebels. If that proves to be true and on a significant scale, it could prove a game changer. The Alawites clearly are moving to Alawite villages and out of Syria, the families of those whose males serve in the security forces, because they're looking ahead and fearing retribution and what will take place in the post-Assad era. So there's a lot going on, and this all impacts Iran because of their heavy investment and need for Syria as a bridge both to Lebanon and directly for them. The Lebanese situation, unstable. Syria, certainly a huge question mark with the violence continuing, and we'll see what will happen today, again a Friday of action.
What did you think of the Obama surge reduction announcement?
Often it's not what you do. I think that there was broad agreement about wanting to reduce it, but the question is when, and the worst thing would be to leave a vacuum that if we don't have the capacity to assure a stable regime afterwards, any of these countries falling, Afghanistan, even Iraq, which we hope will be stable when American troops pull out and we won't see an upsurge in violence and Al-Qaeda and others coming in and taking advantage of the American withdrawal. So being phased is a good idea, but the question is, will we still have the critical mass of support necessary to assure that we have some pacification of the countries and some movement towards peace until they're able to take control of themselves? It's clearly very unpopular amongst the American people. You hear Republicans and Democrats alike criticizing the president's announcement. I guess that there's nothing he would have said that would have gotten universal approval, but many people feel that the way this is being done is the problem, not what is being done.
Is Congress handicapping NATO with the bill that's likely going to pass today, right, in terms of the reduction in financial aid?
I didn't hear the first part.
Or financial support, rather. Is Congress handicapping NATO with the proposal that likely.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Well, it's not handicapping it so much as sending a message. You know, we carry the burdens for the defense of others who don't show great appreciation for the sacrifices that we make. There are people certainly questioning our role in Libya. I mean, what nobody has yet demonstrated who we're helping and what the outcome will be should they win. Are they Al-Qaeda? Are they worse? Are they better people? We don't know, and I think people are looking at the Middle East saying these situations don't lend themselves just to, you know, throwing money at them, which works in some instances, but usually even that is not good enough, or throwing troops or bombs at locations hasn't unseated Gaddafi. It has weakened him, but nobody knows what will be the next step. It's part of the reason I think people are hesitant about Assad, and knowing that we could have a situation of chaos. Most people want to see him go. His murderous actions have only encouraged those who want to see him outed. But if you look at his speech, he mentions vandals 18 times. Right. He talks about conspiracies eight times, and he mentions freedom once. So he's not facing up to the reality. He's still looking to put the blame on Israel, on Lebanon, on all sorts of outside parties for being responsible for the, and the United States, of course, for the violence in Syria, not the lack of human rights, the lack of freedom and opportunity.
Did you meet with President Peres this trip?
I met with him just about an hour and a half ago.
He's enjoying what you would call unprecedented popularity in Israel, or is that an exaggeration?
No, I think he's very popular in Israel. He's the senior statesman, being in his significant 80s. But he is quite remarkable, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with his views. He just finished a three-day conference that he sponsored, and he spoke many times. He attended sessions. There were about 1,700 people from outside the United States and 4,000 altogether. There were some heads of state, but a special track on high-tech, which has been his interest for many years, trying to promote Israel as a high-tech center. I had a discussion with him about many issues and things that are going on. He's you know, he can most entertainingly rattle off the stories of Ben Gurion, for whom he worked for many years, and talking about the relevance of some of those approaches to today. So he's very strong and mentally and physically active.
Do you agree that if former Prime Minister Olmert would have been at the end of his political career of a different political bent, the media in Israel would be paying a lot more attention to the trial that is going on as we speak?
Well, I think the media is paying the trial, but, you know, you get tired when this thing drags on for month after month. You don't get the same kind of story. It's true in the United States, too. People, you know, usually come and surge on the first day into the courthouses, you know, ready to cover a story. But over time, they lose interest. And when there's something juicy that comes out, it makes a headline. When there isn't, it just gets ignored. But that's the nature of the media.
And you don't think it's buried in the newspapers these days because he's a media darling?
No.
Really? A lot of people expressed concerns over a few news items that came across this week. I'm sure you heard about this whole Delta Airlines Saudi Arabia thing. So it's funny how Saudi Arabia often gets a pass. I don't know how they always are under the radar compared to the more perceived radical elements in the Middle East. But they officially will not allow anybody in Saudi Arabia who has Israel stamped on their passport?
No, that is not universally the case. People with Israel in their passports have been allowed in. It's usually if it's arranged in advance. But I know that it is true that they do. There is a policy, though, about it, and they pursue discriminatory policies without condemnation, just so they can pursue other policies. You know, we're seeing a growing split in the region between Saudi Arabia and the United States. They are touting Jordan and Morocco as members now of the Gulf Cooperation Council. It has not been finalized, but they are looking consistently and constantly at Iran. That is their major focus right now, and looking to build a coalition, and they do not seem to see the United States as an ally or have the confidence the United States will take the actions necessary, and therefore they talk about Israel taking on a greater role. But we have to remember that this is Wahhabism is spread from Saudi Arabia around the world, that they have pursued extremist Islamist ideology for the most part, even though they managed to bypass the regulations at casinos and other places. But they have exported it and have supported quite a few of the terrorist organizations, including Hamas and perhaps Hezbollah. The government has sought to counter Hezbollah in Lebanon and try to get Assad to leave or earlier to arrive at some sort of amelioration and to break them away from Iran, but not with great success.
Well,
Saudi Arabia always gets a pass, it seems.
Exactly. It's unbelievable. I mean,
but we have to show that they won't, and it's up to Delta to take the steps necessary to show they won't.
Yeah, they're in a tough spot, that's for sure. 9/11 murderers from Saudi Arabia, by the way, right?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Jonathan Pollard, and by the way, some people have asked for Jonathan Pollard's address, letters of condolence on the loss of his father, and just to be in touch with him in general. After my conversation with Malcolm, before we get to Rabbi Yudin, I will give you, get a pen and paper ready, folks. I'll give you the proper way or most reliable way to correspond with Jonathan Pollard. So I guess there was never much hope that any effort on the part of Jews or any other friends of Pollard would get him out for his father's funeral.
No, I have to say that I did have hope, and we interceded at many levels. What I think is most disturbing, aside from the fact that he was not given some sort of compassionate leave just for a few hours to go and attend the funeral, or might have been even better, is while the father was still alive, they would have been given a few hours to go and visit him in Indiana and escorted. He certainly doesn't pose a flight risk or danger that he would have been at least to have that closure. His mother died 10 years ago, and he was not able to participate then. Now, if it is, in fact, a law or a rule that is universally applied, then they should have said so. The fact that they didn't respond, they didn't even have the decency to give a reason from the Justice Department or others to explain why this, in fact, was the policy, why they did not entertain the briefs that were filed on and letters on his behalf to allow him to get out. So I hope, and I've spoken to some administration officials just in the last hours to try and see if we can get some sort of a clarification, at least to understand what is the root of policy and the decision not to allow him to attend. And it's also, by the way, a weekend when we remember Gilad Shalit, whose fifth anniversary of his imprisonment is going to be Mark Shabbos, and we've urged people around synagogues around the country to say tefillah for groups having meetings or other things to remember him, and and it's time that the government of Israel take the actions that have been proposed, which is to end the privileges, special privileges, not human rights, but special privileges accorded terrorist prisoners in Israeli armies.
All right.
and in different locations.
Armies or jails?
I'm sorry, that the prisoners, terrorist prisoners sitting in the jails, be denied the privileges that are being accorded to them.
And remember, you've pointed out many times that likely wouldn't help anyway, because they probably don't have as much concern for their own prisoners as they
do. But the families become a source of some pressure. Again, not the, you know, the Red Cross has asked just for a sign of life, and Hamas has turned it down. They deserve, you know, whatever retribution possible, this vile actions on their part, not just to punish the government of Israel, but to punish this young soldier and his family and his loved ones. They have rejected every approach from the Red Cross and everyone else. So I'm not sure that we will change them. But if you build internal pressure on them, maybe that would have some beneficial act. And we have a third case also, this young man, Grapple, who's family lives here in New York, who looks like he's going to go on trial in Egypt, though I and many others had believed and hoped that he would be just thrown out.
Yeah, I thought that was a week ago we were talking about it.
Yeah, but that may be what will happen in the end. But
it's
still, it's a dangerous thing when a Jewish boy is put on trial and he had served in the IDF and was not a spy. He may have been adventurous, as I said, and done other things but on his own, but not a Mossad agent, as they said, or a spy for Israel.
Hard to believe that it's 5 years since Gilad Shalit's capture. And I would bet that I mean, I don't know if you could judge these things one against the other, but this is probably one of the things that's on the Prime Minister's mind every single day. It must, knowing him, and you know him probably better than most, probably rips him apart every single day.
Absolutely. And you know, as Rabin once said, you know, presidents of the United States go about their daily lives. They're more or less isolated. They might see a sign of protest, but the Prime Minister sees them outside his house every day. He sees them everywhere he goes, outside his office.
It's right there.
And because it's one family, it's everybody knows somebody who knows them, and it is a tremendous burden that the prime ministers of Israel bear when they have to send soldiers out to war, and why often they're hesitant to do so, because they the consequences affect them directly. It's not just feeling bad that a young man or woman loses their lives.
Unbelievable. By the way, Yale has a new anti-Semitism program. You heard about that?
Yes, I've heard that they have a reconstructed program. We'll have to see yet what it really means. I think it's a shame Dr. Small, Professor Small, is an outstanding individual and has done a great job at the previous Hillel Center, where I had the opportunity to speak and to witness what he was doing. They have come up with certain charges or claims. He had 13 faculty members on his board who reviewed his work. This, as far as I know, was not raised before. Some people think it's because of the focus that they had on Islamist anti-Semitism, and that was not popular among some elements who brought pressure on Yale. I don't know that that's true. We do know that they closed the program and now have reconstituted it. And the question is, will they be assertive as well in addressing the issue of anti-Semitism?
And finally, she passed away this week. I assume you met Yelena Bonner at some point, right?
I have met Yelena Bonner. I met her here in the United States, and indeed her passing reminds us of her husband and her work. And
a different time, huh?
A very different time, absolutely. And it's hard to believe how far back it was. And voices like his, willing to stand up and speak against an authority that he felt was violative of human rights, should remind people today that when we see these violations ongoing, that it's a real responsibility to speak up. It's not just a privilege. It's a responsibility that we have. And you have very few people with the courage of Yelena and her husband and Sakharov to really take on the Russian regime, risk going to jail,
yep,
because of what you believe.
Unbelievable. All right, Malcolm, enjoy Jerusalem. We'll reconvene on the 15th.
And we should remind people that, again, we see a victory where Facebook dropped the Third Intifada app because of protests from the government of Israel, which I believe is very important. We also are seeing a reconstituted Human Rights Council. Half of the resolutions country-specific dealing with Israel. One last point, the new excavations here exposing the biggest First Temple period development and the Watergate, Sharmaim, which supposedly now people can go and visit. Many royal buildings, some of them believed to be part of King David's court and a wall that they believed Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, built. Further attestation to the incredible miracles that are happening, what is being exposed here, that people should come, spend time, take your children there, see the Tanakh, the Bible, come to life in front of your very eyes. Everything that is found, when you look at this, the Watergate, exactly as it is in the Chumash, and many other things that are coming to light here, and all the delegitimizers who say we have no roots here, we have no ties here, the Arab campaigns against the holy places, this is the refutation. So when people see these stories, you should really take nachas. You should understand the message that this is for us.
Oh, amen.
Because we'll be away for 2 weeks leading up to the 3 weeks. It's the right time to remember what happened when we lost Jerusalem.
So I guess that Watergate preceded the more familiar.
Whoa. It was worth getting this last word in to give you that opportunity.
Now I know why they called the hotel that. I assume it was a historic reference. All right. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Enjoy Jerusalem. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.